Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Jerry Kremer. Arthur Jerry Kremer is a 23-year veteran of the New York State Assembly. During his long tenure, he served as the chair of the Energy Committee and then as chair of the prestigious Ways and Means Committee for 12 years. During his time in the Assembly, Mr. Kremer authored dozens of groundbreaking bills that not only became law in New York, but served as the blueprint for similar legislation across the country, including the first in the nation lemon law to protect car buyers. Today, Mr. Kremer is chairman of Empire Government Strategies, EGS, one of the top government relations firms in the Northeast, representing several Fortune 500 corporations and numerous industry trade groups. In his role as New York area chairman, Mr. Kremer is one of the key spokesmen for the energy industry in New York State. He's also leading the charge for legislation to bring the $150 million per year youth hostel industry back to New York City to bolster tourism. We've got a lot to talk about. Mr. Kremer recently published his memoirs, Winning Albany, Untold Stories About the Famous and Not So Famous, which chronicles his five decades in New York State politics. Welcome, Jerry Kremer.
Nice to be with you, Alan.
Nice to see you again. We've all been up here a long time. So let me start by asking you what serving in the legislature was like. Was it your golden days? Are you glad you're out?
Well, I had a spectacular run in the legislature for all those 23 years. They were exciting years. I mean, we did have a lot of legislative giants, you know, whose paths I was lucky enough to cross. Speaker Stanley Fink, Warren Anderson. There were Bucherry, Mario Cuomo. I mean, there were some great dominant figures who really helped shape, you know, the future of the state. And they were exciting times. And I sort of contrast them now with a feeling I get when I come to Albany that a lot of the people I've known for years just keep asking me, how do I get out of here?
And why did you get out? Why did you stop?
Well, number one, you know, you really don't want to hang around waiting for somebody else to retire or die or go to prison. So you make
By the way, just so that our listeners know, the Ways and Means Chairman, which you were, often succeeds to the speakership, the most powerful place in the legislature.
Yeah. Well, there's a geographic dynamic, is there had never been a Democratic speaker from outside the city in my lifetime, and history was running against me. And so I made the decision.
And you were from?
Long Island. So at the beginning of my 13th term, I made a calculated decision that it's really time to get out and go see your family and produce something that's meaningful. But it's not that I didn't love the place. I still do. But everybody should understand that there's a time to turn out the lights and lock the door.
So, Jerry, you got out and then you turned to lobbying. Is this a familiar pattern?
No, well, you know, I waited, Alan. I waited probably 5 years before I even thought about it. It wasn't a revolving door. It was a slow walk.
What'd you do in those 5 years?
And I sort of reconfigured my life. I had lost my first wife. I had to decide what I wanted to do for the rest of my natural life. You know, and then I did some dabbling in law and writing and things like that. And then I said, you know, I want to lobby, but I don't want to be tagged as a, quote, professional lobbyist, because I wanted to do some different things beyond traditional lobbying.
One of your clients, of course, is the energy industry in New York. There is nothing bigger than the fracking debate in this state. What do you make of the dynamics?
Well, I think, unfortunately, for the energy industry in New York, it's a battle that they have lost because they just didn't jump in at the time the people who are against fracking jumped in. You know, all you have to do is travel to all these upstate counties where they desperately need an economic revitalization, and you see the 10 or 12 counties that are really disaster areas who desperately need fracking, who want fracking, who'd be happy to accept rules that just apply to them, and they can't get it. And the energy industry just fell behind in this battle, and it's been won by people who really ultimately want us to go back to burning wood.
Well, there are those people there are those people who think that it's really more than that, that on the anti-fracking side, we don't know the health problems yet, that there have been horror stories coming out of Pennsylvania, that we don't want to mess with our drinking water. And so those are the arguments that have been given. Now, interestingly, whether you're right or whether those folks are right, there is a fascinating part of all of this, and that's the governor's role. When the governor came into office, it was clear he, like the president of the United States, wanted fracking. Now it's the governor who's holding it up.
Well, I haven't met a governor in my lifetime who doesn't hold his finger to the wind to see which way it's going. And because the energy industry blew this one.
How did they blow it?
Well, when all the arguments started being advanced against fracking, when they were passing all these moratoriums in community by community, I mean, it was almost like watching a World War map where you could see where the anti-movement in New York was just had a plan, and the energy industry was asleep. And so I think the governor saw a tremendous amount of pressure from one group and very little support from the others. And I think that resulted in the fact now that nothing's happening.
Do you fault the governor for it?
Look, besides being governor, he also was human. And beyond being a political person, when you start to see this groundswell working against you on some issue, then, you know, a lot of people back off. Unless they're determined, you know, to end their career prematurely. I think, you know, he's done what governors often do and either appoint a committee, delegate it out to some agency. But, I mean, I can't blame him for not willing to jumping into the fray. But we have a more serious problem, Alan. The sun doesn't shine often enough in New York and the wind doesn't blow often enough for us to rely just on wind and solar. And in a lot of communities in New York State, you can't build a wind project. It's impossible. So in the end, we still need more power supply sources. And I talked to a very anti-fracking person 2 weeks ago who said, I said, how do you feel about buses powered by gas, natural gas? He said, they're great. And I said, so how do you feel about fracking? Well, I'm against it. Well, in order to get that natural gas out of the ground and onto the buses, they got to be done. It's got to be created somewhere.
So polish up your crystal ball. Are we going to have it or not?
I would see a possibility of regulations that apply to 10 counties or 8 counties in New York in another year or two. You know, let's point out, you know, fracking is 58 years old in the United States of America. And while there have been a couple of horror stories in Pennsylvania and places like that, the state of Pennsylvania is eating our lunch every day with the amount of revenue that they're getting from the industry, and nobody's dying. You know, these dire predictions haven't really happened.
Let me ask you, you just wrote a very interesting article in the Albany Times Union, and I have great interest in the relationship between Mayor de Blasio and, frankly, Andrew Cuomo fighting for the soul of the Democratic Party in New York. What do you make of that?
Well, Mayor de Blasio, I'm not to be cute, came out of left field. And, you know,
he did.
And, you know, candidly, he was not the favorite by the handicappers in the primary. But his constituency is the one that votes in primaries. And he did very well in the primary. And then all of a sudden...
You mean the left tend to vote in the primaries and the right tend to vote in the primaries for the other guys.
Exactly.
For the Republicans, right.
I think what basically happened is like that Robert Redford movie, you know, now that I'm in charge, what do I do?
Mm-hmm. And candidate.
And I think he's going up the learning curve and it's very steep. I don't think he was prepared for, you know, what politics is like in New York City and New York State. Because, you know, whether you're in Washington as a member of the administration or your public advocate, this is the real ball game in New York, and it's much tougher than where you've been.
Yeah, well, it's an old political science rule that the city is a creature of the state. Perhaps he didn't recognize that.
Well, you know, I mean, all somebody had to do was spend 10 minutes with him, you know, telling him about the words home rule. And the fact that the city, it's a ward of the state, and New York City must go on bended knee to the state, and historically it's done for almost every power to tax. I mean, New York City and the surrounding counties still have to come to Albany in order to put in red lights to stop speeders. So that's one of the more mundane things, but they're at the mercy of the state.
So, Jerry, my sense of it is that there's a different kind of fight going on here. We have the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. As you say, he came out of left field. Indeed, he did. And I think he's a redistributive type of fellow. In other words, he wants to be Robin Hood, wants to take from the people who have a lot and give it to some of the people on the bottom. Will that work for him? I mean, we saw former Mayor David Dinkins not do well, go down in a flame. There are people who think that de Blasio is a reincarnation of Dinkins.
Well, you know, Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, created a substantial number of affordable housing units during his tenure. He had a great run. And it's not that Mayor de Blasio, is trying to pull the city completely to the left and alienate the 1%. But I think, you can't throw every hand grenade that you have in your arsenal at the very beginning of your tenure. You really got to sort of allow each of your ideas to sink in. People in New York City want more pre-K, and these are great programs. But I think the way the mayor is posturing everything right now, it's almost like us against them. And I think hopefully, in the months ahead that, he will realize that, you just have to be a little bit more balanced and nuanced in how you approach everybody in the city.
So how would you play it? If you were advising him and talking into his ear and saying, okay, you want pre-K, and in order to pay for it, you want to tax the rich. Where's the mistake?
Well, I think what the mayor ultimately should try to get out of this legislature, while the legislature can't commit to give him money for the next 5 years because the law doesn't allow it, I think he has to strike a bargain with the legislature whereby he has the assurance that there's a long-range plan, that there will be proposed a specific amount of money allocated over a five-year period that will be segregated in some way that it doesn't detract from the city's revenue stream. And I think he has to cut a deal that allows him to know that he's getting the pre-K money. But the idea of getting a tax, it just won't happen in a year when everybody wants to cut taxes.
And where a New York State Senate is sitting up there.
Yes, well, the Senate in January made it very clear they weren't going to support taxes as the governor did. And it's an election year, and politicians are much more skittish today than they used to be.
Yeah. Something very interesting going on in the state Senate, Jerry, and that is that there is this incredibly unusual coalition of a group of basically white legislators, senators, who didn't want to play ball with, I hate to say it, but a diverse group of folks in the Senate. And now you have this fascinating thing where it's supposed to be split rule, but it looks like they're going along, to me, it looks like they go along with the Republicans. Does that pose political risk for these people?
Well, I think, when you talk about the Senate Democrats, it brings back the old Al Smith statement about, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat.
Circular fire.
Right. And I think what you have here is you have a Democratic minority in the Senate who's weak and disorganized, that's been sort of kicked apart by, some of the ethical problems that some of the members have had. And they haven't found the ability to regroup and become a stronger group. And that the Democrats' weakness has led to the Republican success, whereby they can have a certain number of people, combine them with the independent Democrats, and rule. I'm not really skeptical about it. I think the way government's going these days, it's coalitions that make things happen, and that's what you need.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Your book, Stories About the Famous and Not-So-Famous, give us one not-so-famous story.
Well, I guess there's a lot of them, but I think the meeting I had with Pope John Paul when I had an audience over in Rome, and he had just come from a two-week tour of the United States, and we had a conversation about people in public life, how they can stand in front of the public. Should they look tired? Should they be willing to say, I'm going to beg off now because I've had a tough trip? And he was telling me about, he says, as a politician or as a public figure, you have no luxury to show that you're ever weary, tired, disoriented or disinterested. His words were, he said, whether you like it or not, I do it every day. I don't like the expression, but someone once told me, suck it up. And coming from the Pope, that was pretty strong language.
Well, you referenced some of the great politicians when we were speaking before. I was around for most of them. I don't like to speak ill of the departed, but I felt some of them had really quite a crusty edge to them, like Stanley Fink, who you served under. And I wonder, is that part of the political thing that if you're a Brooklyn Poll when you come to the legislature and you got to be a tough guy?
Well, Stanley Fink, as I really account in my book, he had a macho type of image.
He did.
That cigarette dangling from his hand, which he shouldn't be smoking. And his feeling was is that my conference, my members want a tough guy, a speaker, besides somebody who's knowledgeable. And, you know, he played that role. He wanted to be the John Wayne of the State Assembly, where Warren Anderson was, you know.
The gentleman.
Yes, he was the gentleman. But the combination worked, because in the end, at 12 o'clock in the morning, they could sit down while we were waiting in the speaker's office, but they could sit down and come back an hour later with a little piece of paper with all the things that they agreed on and all the things they agreed would not happen. That kind of openness and camaraderie is gone. And there's no, I don't know of an existing politician in Albany today who has any swagger.
Why is that there is no ability to sit down and do that and like each other?
This started somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, where between the two political parties, this sense of mistrust sort of seeped in. And, you know,
Is it the same thing as in Congress?
Right, same thing. And by the way, that's about the same time when this started in Congress. The idea that it's harder each year for the two parties to work together, that they had different agendas. And this is before the Republican Party got fractured nationally. But this mistrust and division started in the late 80s, and it's just really gotten worse. So there isn't, I mean, while the leaders will meet, the Senate leader has aligned himself more with the governor, so the speaker has to go on his own. So this idea of coalition building just doesn't exist today.
There used to be something called the Bear Mountain Compact,
right,
which meant that after Bear Mountain, what happened in Albany, sexually and otherwise, didn't get discussed. I was in restaurants where guys were with somebody who wasn't their wife, and they were all clapping each other on the back, but nobody would know the guy who was sitting there who was with somebody he wasn't supposed to be with. Has all of that changed?
I think so. You know, back in the days, as I think I pointed out in the book, alcohol was a problem. There's no question. I remember many nights being in an elevator in the DeWitt Clinton Hotel with a member behind me with some young lady who was visiting him who wasn't an immediate relative. And, you know, there were just lots of that going on. And you had senators here, now deceased, not to speak ill, you know, who fathered children, you know, with staff.
And who had mistresses. A lot of people had mistresses.
Exactly right. So, you know, that was a different time. You know, it was freewheeling. But it was also a time when everybody concentrated on the next 10 years and not the next 10 minutes. So, you know, there were trade-offs. A lot of things were getting done.
Yeah. Are you sure you're not just looking back on it with sort of rose-colored glasses and saying, when I was there, it was better?
No, really not at all. I mean, you know, what I like about the current legislature is that they're getting deeper and deeper into problems affecting health care, problems affecting the prisons, problems affecting a whole variety of public issues. So they're not timid. It's just that there's a lot less color. But we haven't lost the desire of a lot of people to make change.
One of the things I loved about what we read in the beginning about you, Jerry, is you're taking on the youth hostel movement as a client, I guess, and trying to get more youth hostels in New York City. What's that about?
Well, 2 years ago, the legislature passed a bill, which 2 or 3 years ago, which Governor Patterson reluctantly signed, having to do with illegal occupancies in the city. And at that time, there were about maybe 15 so-called hostels, and then ultimately,
including a giant one, American Youth Hostels up by Columbia.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And 51 of them were ultimately shut down because the city felt that the occupancy was illegal. So what's going on? And, you know, my interest is getting tourists to come to New York City. And that's my client over in Ireland is a travel agency. They don't own property. We have estimated that New York City is losing between $150 million and $200 million every year because there are no a substantial number of youth hostels. So the city, I think, unknowingly has discouraged the real legitimate hostels.
So what do you want to do? Just build them and legalize them?
Yeah, well, I want to get a law passed down by the city council, which legalizes them. It'll also do away with a lot of illegal occupancies and people renting their apartments out, you know, on an individual basis. It won't stop it. But the best way to increase tourism in New York City really is to have a hostel law. City's doing well. The city could do better.
You raise an interesting issue about renting out your apartment illegally. Many co-ops will not allow that. And sometimes I've thought, as a co-op owner, I may say, that people can pass laws that really do discourage visiting from abroad.
Well, there's no question about it. You know, there's sort of a mix. I mean, if somebody has an illegal unit in their home, you don't want to encourage them to rent that out.
No.
But if somebody has an apartment and they want to go away for 2 weeks, There's nothing wrong with them renting it out as long as they know who the person's going to stay there. But the fact of the matter is the city now, it's in New York City, it's a hodgepodge. You can't have a hostel, but you can have people deciding to rent their apartment out for 3 or 10 nights.
But illegally.
Illegally, right.
So you can't have it, even though you say you can have it.
By the current law, you can't have them.
Okay. So how much pressure is there to have youth hostels in New York?
Well, a lot of the pressure I've tried to create by enlisting the chambers of commerce and a lot of various, business organizations. But, you know, this is an issue that's yet to be faced by the new city council. And I think that this incoming city council now will be a lot more open to bringing more youth in to give them an affordable facility. So my fingers are crossed.
Governor Cuomo says, emphasize, that's capital letter, says that he is for public financing of campaigns. Good idea, bad idea?
Well, you know, if I thought that public financing of campaigns would stop all people from straying from the main road and not get in trouble, and I would say that then let's go do it.
But can't Bernie the bartender have a chance that way or somebody else to run for office as opposed to the political class?
Well, I want Bernie to be able to run and to know that there's a limit on the amount of monies that can be given to his opponent so that they can't build up a war chest. But I'm for stricter campaign limits, but I don't think that public financing does anything. You know, if you want to make the legislature more correct and law-abiding, you have to send out certain messages that you're going to lose your pension if you get convicted of a particular crime, that certain types of things that you may think are allowable are not.
So how come so many people do it, Jerry?
Well, you know, part of it is ignorance. I think a lot of these new people and young people who come in from communities where there may not be a lot of political sophistication come here and someone approaches them and said, I'd like you to sponsor a bill and I'm going to give $10,000 to your campaign. They don't understand that that's wrong. But, you know, we educate new legislators on how the legislature works, but we don't educate them on what the pitfalls are of what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Well, when you were there, Anthony Seminario was still there, was he not?
Well, he came in a little later.
He came later, but he just stole brazenly and he went to prison for it. He's a bright man. How can people do that?
Well, you know, when you have 150 members in the Assembly and so many in the Senate, you know, there are always a few. You know, the mayor was always defensive of the police department in New York City when two out of 29,000 policemen, you know, would get in trouble. The answer is there's always going to be a few. Right now, there's been too many.
I guess I want to know about where we're going. The legislature is incredibly unpopular. Is there a way to make it more popular?
I think that there has to be more recruiting of people to run for office in the legislature.
Who should do that?
Well, it should be done by the leadership in each house. I remember traveling the state to recruit Dan Walsh, who became majority leader. I remember traveling around the state to recruit Jim Talon. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us went out and met with people and said, just like in baseball, you know, there's a real talent here.
But the old days, it would have been the political bosses who did the recruiting. Now, more and more, it's the legislature itself, the parties in the legislature.
Right. It's still up for grabs because there's a lot of places political leaders don't account for too much anymore in any part of New
York. They don't give out the money.
Well, they have nothing to say. The governor gives out all the money. But the fact of the matter is that the so-called leaders are a vanishing breed. And so it needs the political leaders to have the will to do better recruitment.
You're from Long Island. How come the Democrats are doing so badly out there?
What the oddity is that Democrats are now the majority in Nassau County of enrollees and in Suffolk County.
And in Westchester
County.
And
in Westchester.
And they lose.
I think it's partially weak leadership. I think the parties, everybody is basically, wherever you go, is in business for themselves. They're interested in advancing their career. And the net result is that the Democratic Party, Rich Schaefer in Suffolk County is probably the best leader in New York State. He stays on top of things. He looks for good candidates. He looks ahead. A lot of the other leaders they ought to use Rich Schaefer as a model.
Well, Jerry, it's wonderful to have you with us. Mr. Kremer recently published his memoirs, Winning Albany, Untold Stories About the Famous and Not So Famous, New Ideas Press, which chronicles his 5 decades in New York State politics. We are out of time. And Jerry, I hope you'll come back and talk to us some more because your perspective is terrific. And we look forward to that time.
Thank you. I look forward to it, too.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.